is the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Friday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Tomorrow I will be in Los Angeles, but Senator Sanders tomorrow, if you're in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. on the Saturday the 2nd, the 7th, tomorrow morning, Senator Sanders will be speaking at the Progressive Summit in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The website is PA, as in Pennsylvania, progressivesummit.net. And there's also a link over at tomhartman.com if you can't easily remember that. And I'm guessing there might be at sanders.senate.gov. Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Brunch with Bernie with Senator Sanders here. So what's up in the Senate this week?
Well, there is a lot of stuff going on. My mind is kind of focused on what's going on in the Budget Committee because I'm the ranking member there. And we've had two pretty interesting hearings so far, one with the director of the CBO and one with Sean Donovan, who is head of the Office of Management and Budget, the group that writes the budget, helps the president write his budget. So we've had some very good discussions. I think to me, when I look at the situation of the budget, it's absolutely imperative that we write a budget based on the reality of what's happening to ordinary people in America. And what's happening to ordinary people, I think most listeners know, is the middle class continues its 40-year decline. Real unemployment is not 5.8%, it's over 11%. Youth unemployment, 18%. African-American youth unemployment, about 30%. For the family right in the middle of the economy, the median family, that family's inflation accounted for income has gone down by almost $5,000 since 1999. But what we are also seeing, and the numbers are just absolutely almost unbelievable, is a huge transfer of wealth from the middle class to the very, very wealthiest people in this country. What we have seen is that the nation's wealth going to the middle class has gone down from 36% to less than 23% from 1985 to 2013. And if the middle class had simply maintained the same share of the nation's wealth that it had 30 years ago, it would have more than $10 trillion in cumulative wealth. Can you believe that?
Wow. So that's
and then
a 10
on the
trillion.
Other hand,
I'm sorry.
On the other hand, while the middle class continues to shrink, what we have seen just since 2009 is that the top 1% has experienced an $11 trillion increase in its wealth. So what you're looking at is an economy in which middle class wealth shrinks incredibly, and people on top end up with $11 trillion more in wealth. And where we are right now in terms of distribution of wealth, Tom, is the top one-tenth of 1% now owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. A study just came out very recently that in terms of income, since the Wall Street crash, over 99% of all of the new income generated goes to the top 1%, which means that economic growth doesn't mean anything because the people on top doesn't mean anything for the middle class because the people on top get it all. So that's where we are. And then you combine that with the fact that just last week, the Koch brothers reminded us that they intend to buy the next elections. They are prepared, along with a few of their friends, to spend some $900 million on the elections. And just stop and think for a second. If you had 2 million people, a lot of people, providing $100 in campaign contributions, that would be $200 million. That's about 20% of what one family is prepared to spend in the next election. And my guess is they're going to end up actually spending a lot more than that. So when you combine the distribution of wealth, the fact that the top one-tenth of 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%, when you look at income, 99% of all new income going to the top 1%, when you look at campaign spending, in which one family is going to spend close to $1 billion, the second wealthiest family in this country, an extreme right-wing family whose agenda includes ending Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the EPA, giving more tax breaks to the rich, and they're about to buy elections, we have to take a very deep breath and try to figure out where we are as a nation. We are certainly nowhere near being a vigorous democracy. We are moving more and more, in my view, toward an oligarchic form of society. And how do you turn it around? Can we turn it around? There was another story that came out that I thought was very interesting. You and I, Tom, for years have talked about our disastrous trade policies, how NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China have cost us millions of decent-paying jobs. Well, the largest trade agreement in history is called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is coming down the pike pretty soon. There was a study done by a group called Media Matters looking at how much coverage the TPP has received on network news. And you know how much coverage it's received, Tom?
Yeah, with the exception of the Ed Show on MSNBC, it's been zero, basically.
Virtually nothing. So here you have a huge trade agreement, which in my view will have a horrendous impact on jobs and income in the United States, on prescription drug prices all over the world, on issues of sovereignty, and the networks have decided to provide zero coverage to it. So you got all of these issues out there. You got a media, corporately owned media, which does not cover issues of importance to working families. You got a handful of families owning the political process. And you got a massive transfer of wealth from the middle class to the work, to the upper income, to the top 1%. How do you turn that around? Well, anyone who tells you it's easy won't be telling you the truth. But several facts are pretty clear. If we continue to have elections where 63% of the people don't vote, as was the case in the last midterm election, you surely are not going to turn it about. If you have a situation where 63% of the people, as a poll indicated a year ago, don't know which party controls the House or the Senate, we don't know much about the budget, we're not going to turn it around. So what our job has got to be is to, what I often say is create a political revolution in this country, which means change political consciousness so that ordinary people understand, maybe as much as the Koch brothers, how important the political process is. When you hear people out there saying, oh, politics is all crap, all the politicians are the liars and thieves and everything else, I'm not going to vote. Ask yourself why the second wealthiest family in this country is going to spend close to $1 billion on campaigns. They're not fools. They understand that who controls Congress is pretty important. If they think it's important, working people should also think it's important. And then what we need to do is not only change consciousness so that people are involved in running for office in the political process. We have got to have a progressive agenda. Well, what do we do? What do we want? Where do we want to go? And I think we have to be very clear. We need to create millions and millions of decent-paying jobs. How do you do that? Well, among other things, you rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. We have introduced legislation that calls for, along with Senator Barbara Mikulski, that invests $1 trillion in our infrastructure over a five-year period. Tom, that creates 13 million decent-paying jobs. How's that for a start?
Yeah, that's a great start. Exactly what we need. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. Senator Sanders taking your calls and offering answers to your questions. We'll be right back with Senator Sanders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, and you can hop over to Facebook and check out his Facebook page, too. So, Senator, pick up some phone calls.
Let's do it.
Okay. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. You are on the air, Paul.
Yeah, thanks. The president is being demonized over the TPP by allies of Ralph Nader, the guy that gave us 8 years of suffering under Bush. After NAFTA was passed under President Clinton, we had the largest economic expansion in history, 23 million jobs, rising wages. if NAFTA was so bad, why did the economy do so good after it was passed? And also, do you think it's possible that the president is negotiating a deal that will benefit us by raising standards in other countries?
Well, Paul, during the Clinton years, we did see a significant increase in job growth. That is true. And by the way, at the end of the Clinton administration, this country was running, I believe, a $238 billion surplus. So there's a lot to be said about that. But I think the facts with regard to NAFTA is that NAFTA, CAFTA, and permanent normal trade relations with China, those trade agreements have, in fact, been a disaster for this country. And one of the manifestations of that is that while we grew jobs, in many ways, real inflation accounted for wages went down. So you have a situation today where workers, male workers, for example, are making hundreds of dollars a year less than they did 41 years ago. Because since 2001, we have lost 60,000 factories in this country and millions of good-paying jobs. So, Paul, I happen to be one who voted against NAFTA and the other trade agreements. I think it is not fair for American workers to be forced to compete, say, in Vietnam, against people in Vietnam who have a minimum wage of 56 cents an hour. So count me in as somebody who does not believe these trade agreements have worked for American workers. They have been pushed by Wall Street, the Chamber of Commerce, corporate America, and I think we need fundamental changes in our trade policies.
Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, great. Senator, I'm wondering if y'all have been paying attention to what's going on in the House Oversight Committee regarding EPA's failure. They've been blocked by the Inspector General, and the EPA Inspector General, Mr. Elkins, testified on the 3rd to EPA, likening the exception that's been carved out for Homeland Security, as in the Inspector General can't look at what's going on at some EPA facilities. He likened this statute for the IG to a house of cards that's about to fall, and I think that...
Devon, we just have 30 seconds left for Senator Sanders.
Well, Devon, I apologize. I don't know all of the details of what you are talking about. What I do know, and this is certainly no great secret, is the Republican Party is hell-bent on taking apart the EPA and the EPA's ability not only to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, but various levels and various types of pollution. And that is going on 24/7. The EPA is right in their sights, and they're going to do everything they can to weaken and dismantle the EPA.
We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders right after this. It's 20 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane among us. It's Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. And Mike in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's great to talk to you. In the Chicago Tribune this week, it talked about TPP is going to be pretty much wrapped up in March. In that same article, Senator Mark Kirk and Representative Adam Kinzinger, who was came in 2010 on the Tea Party platform, both have said they have a problem giving up our sovereignty over trade, which this would do, and they also said they have a problem with not being able to add no amendments or possibly filibuster, which is they don't want to give up that power. Can you comment on this?
Sure. Mark, what that is about is when you look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or in fact any trade agreement, you're looking at two separate processes. Number one, what's in the bill? And understand that this is a bill that has thousands of pages and a lot of very complicated legalese in it. So that's one thing. Who benefits from this trade agreement? Who gets hurt by this trade agreement? Do the American people understand what's in this trade agreement? As I mentioned a moment ago, the major networks have covered zero of it. But that's another story. So that's one issue. Then the second issue is the process about how we get to vote on the trade agreement. And what that is about is what's called fast track, or giving the president the authority to go forward and negotiate the agreement with 11 other countries or 12 other countries. In the Senate, the major battle will be over fast track, because for that to get approved, it requires 60 votes. To pass the trade agreement will only require 50 votes. And the argument here is the most important argument, to my mind, is the absolute lack of transparency that has been that we have seen in the fast track process. Right now, if a member of the United States Senate or House wants to learn what's in this multi-thousand page, very complicated agreement, 25 separate chapters, one can go in and look at it, but you can't copy any of the information. You can't bring in a trade expert in with you. So in a sense, the elected officials of this country who are asked to vote on whether or not we go forward really have no way of fully understanding what is in the document and what it means to their constituency. So it would seem to me that if for no other reason, even if one likes what one ended up seeing, one should vote against fast track, because there has been virtually no transparency. And that's what that is about, Mike.
Okay. Jim, in Lockport, Illinois, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom. Good afternoon, Senator Sanders.
Jim.
Last Thursday, you gave a great presentation on the Senate floor after the Keystone vote on income inequality. And you had a nice chart up there that showed that the income inequality started under the Reagan administration and continued to grow. Now we hear Republicans, they're talking about income inequality. And they have the nerve to blame our president on that. Yet they still want to give tax breaks to the rich, like the Koch brothers, who say they want to spend $900 million on buying our next election. And to me, that they should be ashamed, because they can't afford to pay more.
So, Jim, your question?
My question is this. Isn't, now that the Republicans are talking about income inequality, isn't that an indictment of trickle-down economics?
Yes, it is, Jim. Absolutely. And the chart that I had, and maybe at some point, Tom, I'll bring that chart down here. We can put it on the screen. Was very interesting. What Jim is talking about is there's a chart out there that showed that going way back to the late 40s, the 50s, what type of, who benefited and who received the most income during economic recoveries. So when you had a recovery back in the 40s and 50s, the overwhelming beneficiaries of that recovery were the bottom 90% of the people. That's where the money went. And what you see as a result of trickle-down economics is from 1982 to the present, increasingly the beneficiaries of economic recovery are the top 1%. And right now you are seeing the most extreme numbers, where virtually all of the benefits are going to the top 1%. So what I was talking about is my view that trickle-down economic theory, which says that to create jobs we need to give tax breaks to the rich and large corporations, we need more deregulation, just the way we deregulated Wall Street, that makes no sense at all if you're talking about the needs of the middle class and working families. So trickle-down economics is totally discredited. It's not just the theory. In reality, it has failed. We need an alternative approach. And the point that I made on the floor is, Tom, we hear a whole lot of discussion about the so-called job creators. That's what the Republicans talk about. Well, you know who the job creators are? The job creators are the people who are listening to this program. The job creators are the middle class and working class of this country, who every day go out and they buy products and they buy services. And the reality is that if working families do not have disposable income to go out and purchase, then companies can't create jobs. You could have the smartest CEO in the world, but that CEO can't sell a product if people do not have the money to buy that product. 70% of our economy is based on consumer consumption. Wall Street Journal just the other day had an interesting article. They're talking about a two-tier economy. For the rich, for the companies that sell to the rich, they're doing really well. For companies that sell to the middle class, they're in a lot of trouble because the middle class doesn't have the money to buy what it needs.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. We'll be back with more of your calls for the senator right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And you can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And, of course, you can track him down on Facebook. He's got a very active Facebook page. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And David in Wilmington, Delaware, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. My question is, there's two parts. I want to know the variables that keep a person from voting, and I wonder if there will be any movement by the, and I'm sure it would be a Democrat, by the Democratic Party to get this thing overturned where felons cannot vote. I think that's I think that hurts Democrats in every election, and it is a way that the 1% keep control over us by keeping felons, and I wonder what other variables.
Got it, David.
Particularly the minority.
Yep. Thank you, David.
Well, thank you, David. And David asked a very, very important question, and it gets to the question as to the nature of American democracy today. In the last election, 63% of the American people didn't vote. 80% of young people didn't vote. 75-80% of low-income workers didn't vote. Now, that was an off-presidential election. Those numbers go up during a presidential election. But what that speaks to, in my mind, is, A, the alienation of the American people from the political process and their demoralization. The American people are hurting. The middle class is disappearing. Poverty is almost at an all-time high. We have lost millions of decent-paying jobs. Most of the new jobs being created are part-time and low wage, and Americans look to Washington and they say, what are you doing? Who are you representing? Are you relevant to my life? I can't afford to send my kid to college. I can't afford child care. I have to work two or three jobs to make a living. What are you doing about it? And they look into Washington, and it turns out that in Washington, Koch brothers and other billionaires are putting huge amounts of money into the political process. And Congress says, Koch brothers, what do you want? You don't want us to raise the minimum wage? Hey, we're there with you. You want us to deny that climate change is real and caused by human activities? Hey, count us in. We're with you. You want us to have more unfettered free trade so you can ship jobs to China or Vietnam? Hey, we're with you. And the American people are saying, you know, why do I want to participate in this charade? And I'm going to stay home. So I think, David, that is at the heart of why voter turnout is so low. And I think there is no easy antidote to that. It's going to take a lot of grassroots education and organizing. It's going to take really strong candidates at the local level, the state level, for national office, who are bringing people together around a progressive agenda, who remind people of what Abraham Lincoln talked about, the government is supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people, not for the billionaires. Now, that's not easy stuff. You turn on television, the most important issues facing us, not even discussed. Talk radio, 95% of talk radio is right-wing, which is why I love this show, why Tom and I have worked together for so many years. It's an alternative point of view. But this is tough stuff, how you get lower-income people, working people involved in the political process. And then David asked about felons. Well, felons overwhelmingly will be lower income people who commit crimes. And then they're disbarred from the political process. Yes, we of course have got to rethink that and bring those people who have paid their obligations to society, bring them back into the democratic process.
And, just a quick announcement, Senator Sanders will be speaking at the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, tomorrow morning at 10 in the morning. That's February 7th. For more information, go to PA, as in Pennsylvania, progressivesummit.net. Didn't want to forget to get that in there, Bernie. Anthony in Bethpage, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
How you doing? So this disintegration of the middle class and the growth in poverty occurred under 35 years of rule by both Democrats and Republicans. Democrats had the White House for half the time. Why should I trust the Democratic Party just because the Democrats are worse, because the Republicans are worse? Because I'm not seeing anything truly progressive happening. And, this is why I occupied Wall Street. I don't have faith in either of those parties. That's my question.
Well, Anthony raises a reasonable question, and I trust, as you know, Anthony, I am an independent, the longest-serving independent in the history of the United States Congress, was elected as a mayor, congressman, senator, as an independent. And I think where we are politically is that you have right now a Republican Party, which over the years has evolved from a center-right party, the party of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who built the largest public works program up to then in our history, the interstate highway system, who proudly talked about raising the minimum wage, etc., to a right-wing extremist party under the dominance of the Koch brothers, who want to abolish Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, etc. And then you have a Democratic Party, which, you know, under FDR, I think could honestly be called the party of the American working class. You had a president who was prepared to stand up to what he called the economic royalist of his time. I call him the billionaire class of our time, and took them on and stood with working people. And in 1936, he won 46 out of 48 states. But that party, the Democratic Party, has also evolved to be a party significantly impacted by big money. And I think, Anthony, the question you have to resolve, and it's a tough question, is the Democratic Party more progressive than the Republican Party? There is no debate about that. Yes, they are. Within the Democratic Party, there are some very strong voices of people who are trying to do exactly the right thing, to stand up to big money, to raise the minimum wage, to deal with the scandal of overtime, to deal with pay equity, to deal with these disastrous trade agreements, to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, to deal with climate change. All of those people are in the Democratic Party, and some of them are quite progressive. But if your point is the party as a whole terribly progressive? I think the answer is no, it is a centrist party. And then you, Anthony, and a lot of other people have to make, you know, political decisions based on that. So that's kind of where it is. It is. You have an extreme right-wing party, and I think it's important that we do everything that we can to stop their growth. But you have a Democratic Party which is not anywhere near as strong as it should be in representing working families.
John in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I'm calling about the cuts to Social Security disability, and where they say it's going to be 20%. Okay, now I did some math on this, and if they cut down 20% for the 9 million, it's not going to make the program last at all. Actually, it's a farce, and we know it. Because all they're going to do is get their toe in the Social Security, and then they're going to try to destroy the programs they so hate. The other problem I have in seeing this is I'm grateful to see that there are some disabled people that still have employment and employers making arrangements for them.
Right. John, is there a question in there for the senator?
Well, I know what the question is,
okay.
Tom.
Got it. Thank you, John.
I'm on the committee that's dealing with – John, thank you very much for raising the issue. I was going to try to get it to it later in the program. What John is referring to is the fact that on the very first day of this new congressional session, the Republicans passed a rule which essentially said they would not allow to happen what has happened 11 times in recent history on the Democratic and Republican parties, and that is the reallocation of money from one pot within Social Security to the other. Two major pots, the retiree pot, the larger pot for older people, which most people refer to as Social Security. But there's another pot which provides benefits for 10 million people, which is the disability program. And the disability program is going to run out of funds next year. What has always happened, because they're paid for out of the same source of money, is when the older retiree, the retiree pot had money, money was simply transferred into the disability pot. When the older pot, the pot for older people was running out of money, they took money from the disability pot. That's what they did. Republicans are saying, we don't want to do that. If they don't do that, that will require a 19% cut in benefits. There's going to be a hearing in the Budget Committee next year, next week on Wednesday, on just that issue. Here is the point. What the Republicans have done is created a phony crisis. There is no crisis. 11 times in recent years, we have made these transfers. What they are trying to do is, I think John indicates, is begin the process of dismantling and cutting Social Security. And what they want to do is create a situation where they're going to try to target the disability community against the seniors and the seniors against the disability community. Now, the good news, John, is that the AARP, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, the Alliance for Retired Americans, all of the senior organizations are standing with people with disabilities and saying, do not cut programs for disabled Americans. These are some of the most vulnerable people in this country. Many are children, a million are veterans. These are people who are suffering from terrible diseases, etc. So we are going to fight as hard as we can to make people understand that Social Security is not going broke, that in fact there is a $2.8 trillion surplus in the program. It could pay out all benefits to all older Americans and disabled Americans for the next 18 years, period.
We will be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders taking your questions in our national town hall meeting. Be sure to check out Bernie's websites, sanders.senate.gov, bernie.org. There's a Facebook page, plug Senator Sanders in, and you can tweet him at Senator Sanders.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back. Fifteen minutes before the hour, Anita in San Antonio, Texas, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Anita.
Senator Sanders, do you have any idea why President Obama supports the TPP? And do you think there's any chance we could change his mind? Or will we have to completely rely on Congress to stop it? And what are the chances of that?
Anita, the truth is, I don't think you're going to change President Obama's mind on this issue. I think he is taking the position that President Bush took before him, that President Clinton took before him, that President Bush the first took before him, and that Ronald Reagan took, and that is that unfettered free trade works for America. I think our hope lies in the Congress. I have been working with members in the House. In the House, to the best of my knowledge, the vast majority of Democrats are opposed to this agreement. There are some Republicans who, for their reasons, are also opposed. I think the fight is going to be harder in the Senate, which has historically been more sympathetic to free trade than the House. But I think my understanding is that we do have a shot to defeat this in the House.
Floyd in Terre Alta, West Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Senator Sanders, thank you for everything you've done. I got a couple things. First of all, I want to tell you that the people I talk to want you to run as a strict independent, and we need a progressive partner to go with you. My question is why, with all the states in this country, has made marijuana legal either for medical or for normal use, why our government hasn't changed the policy and took it off of Schedule 1 whenever the majority of the states has already said that it's legal in this country, you know? I'd like to know why somebody hasn't introduced a bill to get it off of there. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Floyd. I think what you are seeing is a significant evolution on this issue. Colorado has legalized marijuana. There is a lot of debate in my state and states all over the country to move in that direction. I think people are trying to ascertain what is going on in Colorado, how well it is working, what problems may be arising. But I would say, Floyd, like in many other issues, things don't happen overnight. But clearly the trend is to decriminalize. I think you're seeing more and more states decriminalizing marijuana, people who have small amounts of it. And that is the direction that it is moving in. You have, on the other hand, law enforcement folks who worry about marijuana leading to cocaine, leading to heroin, which is a very serious problem, and that's kind of where the debate is right now. But there's no question that I think the trend is toward a liberal direction in terms of marijuana.
And a fine thing it is. It seems that there's also some pushback from the pharmaceutical and tobacco industries. Yep. We will be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders here taking your questions. More of your questions for Bernie right after this. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Sanders on the line with us from the Senate Recording Studio. Joe in Clark's Summit, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Senator Sanders, you brought up a great point before about voter disenfranchisement that keeps people back from the polls. But I'm 30 years old, and many of my friends and colleagues, we simply do not vote just because the day. I mean, especially it's a Tuesday. It's the middle of the work week. Many people don't work and live in the same districts, so it's just impossible for us without having to take the day off of work or at least leave work and have a significant pay cut for the day's work to go and vote. And the people that do show up to the polls are the people who are retired, and they have nothing better to do than to go to the polls. So, I mean, we need to do something about changing, if not changing it from a Tuesday to a weekend or some national holiday, at least keeping it open later the polls than 7 o'clock. I mean, we have better access to the malls than we do the
well,
polls.
Joe, you raise a very important point, and as you may know, I have introduced legislation to make Election Day a national holiday for exactly the reasons that you have given us. Number one, there are, and the length of time or how late polls stay open is dependent upon the state. But the truth of the matter is, if we are serious about encouraging people to participate in the political process, it is not a good idea that in some states, you know, as Joe indicated, people drive off to work. They're going to have to race back, or maybe they can't even make it to the polls. I think if we respect and appreciate American democracy, then we can at least devote one day a year, one day every 2 years at least, to making sure that everybody has the opportunity to participate, that they're thinking about democracy, they're thinking about the election, not to mention having the time to go out to vote. So my view is, Joe, that we should take a hard look at why our voter turnout is so low. We should do everything that we can to increase voter turnout, and having a one day every 2 years, making that a national holiday, call it Democracy Day, I think is what we should do for all the reasons you gave.
Rudy in Riverside, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator, when will you and other progressives in the Congress propose a transaction tax, a carbon tax, and go to paper ballots in elections? Larry Summers just this week proposed a carbon tax when he was on Charlie Rose's program. So if he's for it, maybe some others will be for it.
All right, Rudy, let me give you the news. About 2 years ago, Senator Barbara Boxer and I introduced legislation which included a carbon tax. I happen to think that climate change is the major planetary environmental crisis that we face. I think a very effective way of cutting carbon is to tax carbon emissions, and that's what we did several years ago. And I think there is momentum for that. Number two, in terms of a transaction fee on Wall Street, we have also been on board that. We have introduced legislation, Senator Tom Harkin introduced legislation, and if we are serious about wanting to damper and slow down speculation on Wall Street, this is a step forward. It's a smart thing to do, and it also brings in a substantial sum of money. So on those two issues, I think you're seeing somebody, some of us already on board. What was your third point? What was the third point, Tom?
I recall? Don't paper ballots, transaction
paper
tax.
Ballots, that's a that's a decision being made by the states. And some states, I believe, Tom, are moving in that direction.
Yeah.
Is that not right?
Yeah, Oregon, Washington State, Colorado, increasingly. Yeah, with the mail-in voting. Okay, David in Mill City, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator, and thank you. Thank you especially for your comments on the TPP, though I think you're grossly understating the impact of the provision that requires us to pay to regulate. Because the first stage you're doing, a first stage of that law, you're doing a good job of, other than you've missed the little details.
David, what's your question?
Taxes reduce profits. Is there a reason that you haven't gotten to the second stage, which is that we have to start repealing laws because we can't afford to pay for the regulation?
That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think you want to repeal laws that don't make any sense. You want to strengthen laws that do make sense, but I think as a general principle, you don't go around repealing laws if they are working effectively. And I would say, by the way, when the issue, when we talk about the issue of regulation or deregulation, you know, you got to look at the specifics. I was one of those, when I was in the House, who fought very, very hard against the deregulation of Wall Street. Did not believe that it was a good idea to allow huge insurance companies to merge with huge banks and so forth and so on. Well, turns out I was right. And I think we have to re-regulate those institutions very strongly. But even more importantly, we've got to start to break them up. So, David, there's a time for regulation. There's a time for deregulation. But I think in many instances, what we need to do is make sure that corporate America does not develop practices which are harmful to working families, and they need to be regulated.
Senator, we have just a minute left. Do you want to share your thoughts on the coming week?
Yeah, let me get back to an issue which is very much on my mind. It was raised earlier in the program, and that is this attack on Social Security. The Republicans are going to create a phony crisis by telling us that the disability part of the program is running out of money. Once again, the funding comes from one source, which is the payroll tax. 11 times in recent history under Republican and Democratic presidents, with no controversy at all, money was transferred from one pot to the other. That is what the president proposed in his budget. That is exactly what we should be doing. The long-term game plan of the Republicans is to use this as an attack on Social Security, both the disability program and the old age program. We must not allow them to succeed.
Senator, thanks so much once again for being with us this week. Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's always wonderful. Thank you. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this. Stick around. Coming up on the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. The news of the day is rather interesting. I don't know if you caught this. There hasn't been much conversation about it in the media. But the Republican, the Department of Homeland Security has to be refunded. That is, we have to once again put money in to fund them going forward for the next year by February 27th. This is February. The 27th is about 3 weeks from now, 2.5 weeks. And if it's not, if it doesn't get funded, then there'll be all kinds of layoffs at the Department of Homeland Security. And theoretically, all the airports would come grinding to a stop because TSA people weren't working and stuff like that. And the fact of the matter is that this has happened before. We've seen these kind of things, where the Republicans are playing games with the national, with the federal budget, and they don't care if, some federal employees get hurt. In fact, I think they delight in it. And, TSA employees and the other DHS employees will almost certainly show up and work for free, in large part because they're not really working for free. That in the past, whenever this has happened, Congress always authorizes a retroactive payback to them, for having worked. But the net of the whole thing is that this is all because the budget for the Department of Homeland Security has attached to it an amendment that says that President Obama cannot use federal money to implement his Dreamer program and some of his other tinkering around the edges of our immigration to the extent that he can through executive order. It would be just like the thing that they've been putting into the NDAA now for 6 years in a row, the National Defense Authorization, which has to be done every 2 years by according to the Constitution, that says that the president may not use any federal money to close Guantanamo Bay. Because the Republicans want to make sure that Obama leaves office with this scar, this scab, this recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all the rest of them, of Guantanamo Bay. It is keeping Guantanamo open. This thing that the Republicans are absolutely committed to is one of the worst things that we can do. It's one of the best helps for the terrorists, basically. Because they point to Guantanamo and say, you think we're bad? Look at what America did. Yeah, they killed people there. They're still torturing. Yeah, they don't believe in the rule of law. They've got people there who never committed any crime, and they've been there more than a decade. You think we're barbaric? Well, yeah, I do think that they're barbaric, but in any case. So the Republicans wanted to undo, because their base is all freaked out about, oh, my God, he's going to let, a couple of million Hispanics, brown people, we can't have that. And so the Republicans put this in the bill. It came out of the House, and then it went to the Senate. And, of course, in the Senate, turnabout is fair play. The Democrats can now filibuster things, and they filibustered it 3 days in a row. And so now the House Republicans are saying, well, we passed the bill. It's up to the Senate. And the Senate Republicans are saying, but you passed a bill that the Democrats are filibustering, so, you got to come up with a different bill. And we'll put some kind of a fig leaf on there so that the base will think that we did something, but we've got to fund the Department of Homeland Security. And so now we've got this argument going on, literally within the Republican Party, between the Boehner, Republicans in the House, and the Mitch McConnell Republicans in the Senate. It's absolutely bizarre, absolutely bizarre. Benghazi, the Democrat, the Republicans have created. Now this, a new point here. This is something that the Republicans are doing exclusively to take down Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of the State, Secretary of State at the time that our ambassador to Libya and two CIA officers and one other person from the embassy, or two security guys and one other person from the embassy, were killed in Benghazi. Now, this has been looked into by committee after committee after committee, by the executive branch, by the congressional branch. I mean, everybody but the Supreme Court has looked at this thing and concluded that there's no there there. You know, it was a terrible thing that happened, but we've had ambassadors die in situations not that different from this situation multiple times during the George W. Bush administration, during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, during the Ronald Reagan administration. We've had diplomats die. Only once during the Obama administration, but the Fox News machine, the right wing hate radio and Fox so-called news, they are amping this thing up, and the Republicans in Congress are preparing their committees, and the Democrats are going, hey, there's no there there. What is it that you want to talk? And the Republicans are going, we're going to interview people without the Democrats in the room. Really? What's happening right now, there's an awful lot of prep going on right now that people are not even noticing. The Republicans are getting ready for 2016. Project One, bloody up Hillary Clinton, beat her up badly. Benghazi is, you know, at the top of the hit parade in their mind for that, given that, you know, it's become a word synonymous with scandal, just, you know, among the right, among Fox News viewers. So, number one, Benghazi. Number two, you know, organize the billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to support Republican candidates. And then, you know, it just goes on and on, right down through the list. So anyway, we'll see where this goes, but keep an eye out on this. And the other thing, of course, is that the Republicans on the first day they came into office in the House of Representatives, they passed a rule that where they forbid themselves from balancing Social Security's retirement fund versus its disability fund, so that there will be a phony baloney crisis around the Social Security disability insurance sometime right around the 2016 election. You think these guys aren't, I mean, they're playing politics seriously for the long haul and getting ready. I mean, they're just seriously getting ready. Oh, and do you hear this? This is one of those kind of gossipy things, but it's fascinating how much press it's getting. Apparently those pages didn't print, but this is from Victoria Jones's news report. But apparently, when according to President Obama, and this is from David Axelrod's new book that just came out, he writes that when Mitt Romney called Obama to concede, he said words to the effect of, you did a great job in Cleveland and Buffalo or something like that. And in big cities with large black populations. And President Obama was not smiling, and he hung up the phone and he said to his people, he congratulated me on turning out the vote in these big cities. He said, in other words, he thinks that the reason that I won and he lost is because of black people. You know, like, Romney still doesn't get it. And Romney's people now are saying, no, what's in the book is wrong. Romney would never say anything like that. Romney didn't know what was going on. He was just, you know, kind of a bupkis who happened to be there. You know, he just. And Obama's people, several people who were in the room, Jay Carney and a couple of others, are saying, no, the way the president conveyed the story is exactly how it happened. So now we've got Romney concession gate. I don't know. But anyhow, it is Friday. We'll spend the rest of the show on topics of concern to you as well as to me. So stick around. We'll be picking up your calls right now. It's 15 minutes past the hour on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Harbin Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be right back with your calls on Anything Goes Friday. By the way, my new book is out. It's called Death in the Pines. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lowell in Waite Hill, Nebraska, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Lowell, what's up?
How you doing?
Good.
I'm good. It's actually Walt Hill, Nebraska.
Oh, okay.
But my question is, I've had enough of Democrats, I've had enough of Republicans, and I've had enough of independents. I want to remove my consent. I was born in this country. How is that possible?
To remove your consent to being governed by...
Correct.
Yeah. I think the only way you can do that is to leave the United States and renounce your citizenship.
Well, I don't... Well, see, here's the thing. I live in two countries. America, which is...
Your phone is breaking up, Lowell. You want to try that again? I heard you say, I live in two countries, and then your phone just started disintegrating. Lowell? If you can hear me, I can't hear you. You might want to try and give us a shout back. Yeah, oh, Lowell just dropped off the phone. Okay, let's see if Greg in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Greg, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. How are you?
So, great. What's up?
So I learned something recently I wanted to share on the air. I used to call into Sam Cedar's show, and he is very much against libertarians. And I always wondered, why am I more sympathetic to them? And I listened to Milton Friedman give an interview a few years ago, and I realized why that is. There's two types of libertarians, and the type, I guess, that I'm more sympathetic to are called consequentialist libertarians. They look at outcomes rather than a priori moral, you know, truths that they try to divine. And if things lead to better outcomes, then they base the policies on that, just like liberals would or conservatives would try to do. So just to give you one example, if there was unconditional basic income for everybody, and then we could eliminate minimum wage laws, what that would do, besides possibly saving money, what that would do is allow people who don't have a great education to then have an opportunity to work on the job, either as an unpaid intern or something like that, and have an opportunity to then be more productive and create more value for society. So that's an example of a libertarian position that's based on outcomes.
It's actually not a libertarian position, because libertarians do not believe that the government giving you income is an appropriate function of government.
Well, that's the...
I mean, what you're describing are rationalists. You're describing people who believe in cause and effect. But you know, libertarianism is a very fixed... It's an ism. It's a belief system. It's not... I mean, you know, this consequentialists versus deontological libertarians. I don't think you're going to find any.
I mean, Milton Friedman was a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he was definitely a consequentialist libertarian. He, in fact, the earned income tax credit is a result of his negative tax proposal, which is basically kind of like basic income.
No, I understand that. And he also was a fan of a national health care system, a single-payer national health care system, in fact. Milton Friedman suggested that was an appropriate place for government to be involved. But Milton Friedman is not, you know, the godfather of libertarianism. Milton Friedman is the godfather of Friedmanism and the Chicago School of Economics. And there's a lot of holes there, too. But very interesting, Greg. I'll have to dig a little deeper on that. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the heads up. We'll be back. Hey, Tom Hartman here. The organic wine company, EcoWine.com, is unique in that they stock a wide variety of handcrafted organic wines from their very own small family-owned vineyards in France. Véronique's 75-year-old grandfather, Pierre Fabre, a professor of medicine, converted the family farm, La Bosquette, to organic wine. And now Veronique Raskin's mission is to share her passion for high-quality organic wine with those who enjoy wine. Drinking organic wine reduces your exposure to harmful chemicals, reduces the impact of pesticide use on the people who grow the grapes, reduces the threat to groundwater contamination, and helps to promote biodiversity. More information at ecowine.com. It is 20 minutes past the hour, the place where despair is not an option. The Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars. Mark in Janesville, Wisconsin. Hey, Mark, welcome to Anything Goes Friday. What's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, I had a question.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, what is the likelihood of some of these NAFTAs and CAFTAs and some of these things reversed? And my second question is, what's the chances of possibly an Elizabeth Warren and a Bernie Sanders hand going and confronting the president and trying to persuade him on how devastating these crazy trade deals have been to manufacturing in the United States and reverse his decision to stop his whole fast-track deal?
I believe Senator Sanders told us on the air, I might be mixing it up with something else, but I believe some 3 or 4 months ago he told us on the air how he expressed his opposition to TPP directly to President Obama. I know he meets with him and talks with him with some regularity. With regard to stopping the TPP, Bernie said today on this air, on this program, that he believed that there was a growing consensus in the House in particular to block TPP. And what's fueling that is you've got the entire Progressive Caucus, which is like, you know, the largest caucus in Congress, about 90 or 100 members of the House of Representatives, Democrats, who are opposed to it because it's bad policy. I mean, we can admit that Bill Clinton made a mistake, you know, and with NAFTA, rather than compounding the mistake, let's just admit the mistake. And then on the right, on the Republican side, you've got 60 or 70 Tea Party Republicans who are very strongly opposed to SHAFTA, to the TPP, because they're concerned that it's going to surrender American sovereignty. And, you know, it's the same reason they're opposed to our being part of the United Nations. So it may be that we have enough of a coalition, and that's why Senator Sanders is suggesting, or I believe he suggested, that people, we all have two senators. Actually, I don't here in D.C., but pretty much all the rest of you all have two senators and one member of the House of Representatives. That's three people to call, and the White House, if you want to call the White House comment line, as soon as possible, because they're, you know, Boehner and Mitch McConnell are going to try and get this fast-track thing through so that SHAFTA can become a reality. Mark, thanks for the call. That's that, you know, with regard, oh, and with regard, Mark, to rolling back the previous free trade agreements that are doing so much harm to the United States to this day, I think that if we can stop SHAFTA, that begins the undoing of NAFTA and CAFTA. But, you know, it's going to take some time. Kathy in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hi. I just would like to comment and put my personal feeling that in so many discussions that we have right now, we're talking about, well, what do we want? And I think a lot of us know, because we followed politics so closely, what the people want. And Bernie really represents that to such a great extent. But I think we're getting the cart before the horse, because none of the things that will be beneficial to us are going to happen until we get more progressives and Democrats elected. And I think that's the conversation that we need to have right now, is talking about what do we do to change this giant boulder that's rolling down the hill, and we have to figure out how do we stop it.
Yeah.
And I just have a thought or two. Of course, I'm not an expert in this, but I just have a thought. And one of them is that you have to stop beating the hand of the dog that bites you. And by that, I mean, we keep buying products of people that are killing us. And obviously the Koch brothers, but there's many others too. And I think we need to, the only way it will work is if we do this as an entire country, and that we agree we're going to take on this company, this company, this company, just a few at a time, and do major, major boycotts. I hate to mention that word. But that is one of the things that I think that could work. The other thing is that as Democrats, we have to stop allowing so many Democrats to vote with Republicans. that were, for instance, one of the major things that we all want right now is for Wall Street not to have the opportunity to do what they did before. And yet 29 Democrats voted with Republicans. I believe it was 2 days after the Republicans took office that the vote was taken to change that and to give the ability for Wall Street to fail again and for the middle class to be handed the bill.
Right.
We need to keep people in line. But these are just a few ideas. And I think I'm just throwing out the hope that we can have more conversations about how do we get to the point where we can have what we need.
Yeah. Kathy, I got it. I got it. And in fact, and thank you for the call. For years, I have been advocating that I have strongly suggesting, in fact, when we come back from the break at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to play a couple of clips about it, that people get involved in the Democratic Party. There was a serious effort back in 2009, 2010 to get Republicans to show up, to get people who identify as Republicans to show up at the local Republican Party meeting and run for precinct committee person. Precinct committee person is basically, you know, one of the most powerful jobs in politics. And in most places, in most states, you can get this job. And in some cases, it even pays. Typically, it doesn't. But, you know, it's like, you know, one or two nights a week or a month of your time. But you, as a precinct committee person, you get to decide the platform of the party. You get to decide who are the primary candidates. And this campaign to get Republicans to sign up, to get Tea Partiers to sign up, to infiltrate the Republican Party back in 2010 was incredibly successful, what these guys did 5 years ago. And I'll play some clips from that for you so you understand what I'm talking about. I think this is the path. We need to do what's, you know, it's already been done. It's been done at the Republican Party. It works.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I'll play those clips when we come back, and then we'll pick up more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday. Piegophiliously ugly, the good. Wales. On Wednesday, the parliament of this British country voted to ban fracking, quote, until it is proven to be safe in both an environmental and public health context, end quote. Now, the second country in the UK to ban fracking in less than a week. Scotland did the same thing last week, and now the pressure's on the rest of the UK to follow suit. Let's just hope lawmakers here in the US are paying attention. And we'll now start taking action on fracking right in our own backyard. And that Cheney loophole, be a good idea. Get rid of that. The bad. Brian Green, the Utah State Representative, is really struggling to understand this whole consent thing. Just to check out what he said Tuesday during a hearing about proposed changes to Utah's rape laws.
It looks to me now like sex with an unconscious person is by definition rape. I hope this wouldn't happen, but this opens the door to it. An individual has sex with their wife while she is unconscious, or he, you know, the other way around, if that's possible, I don't know. But a prosecutor could then charge that spouse with rape.
Yeah, actually, Brian, having sex with a person without their consent, spouse or not, that's the definition of rape. And by the way, that was just about the creepiest thing I've ever heard a politician say. And the very, very ugly Benjamin Cole, the press secretary for Illinois Congressman Aaron Schock, you know, the guy with the lavishly decorated bright red office. He had to resign Thursday, the chief of staff, after Think Progress and BuzzFeed uncovered a series of racially charged posts on his Facebook page. One of the posts, Cole included a video of his African-American neighbors, along with a caption that read, "So, apparently the closing of the National Zoo has forced the animals to conduct their mating rituals on my street." He then included a hashtag that read, "Gentrify Today." That is very, very ugly. Okay, the Concord, I believe it was called the Concord Coalition, and this was back from 2010, and this was a group that was their job, and I, to this day, I'm not sure anybody knows exactly where their money came from, but I'm guessing that a lot of it probably began, with the Koch brothers. But their job was to get Tea Partiers inside the Republican Party to take over the Republican Party. So let me just play you a couple of clips from these videos that they sent out. They sent out thousands of these DVDs to people in 2009 and 2010 to get them involved. Here's one.
How does one become a precinct committeeman? Bottom line, every state has different rules and procedures for becoming a precinct committeeman with full voting rights within the parties. And each party within each state may have different rules. In Arizona, for example, you must be elected to the office of precinct committeeman. But you don't have to get more than 10 signatures of registered voters from your party or from independents to get your name on the primary ballot. Precinct committeemen in Arizona are not required to pay dues. Ohio's system is similar to Arizona's. Other states require dues and require precinct committeemen attend meetings and sign pledges to support the party's candidates. Arizona's system does not require meeting attendance.
So that's, one thing about how, what the deal is with becoming a precinct committeeman. Here's another one of their pitches.
So how do you find out how it works in your state? The best way is to contact your state or county political party organization and find out where your local party committee meets. Get on the internet and find it. Use the phone book. Call information. Then contact your party organization and find out when and where they meet. Then go to the meeting and ask how one becomes a voting member of the party. Take other conservatives with you. Be persistent. Don't be bashful. And before you go, you may want to get on the internet and see how much information already exists about how things are done in your state.
See, they're just openly, straightforwardly saying, you, conservatives, you Tea Partiers, you need to take over the Republican Party. Here's another clip from this sales pitch from the Concord Coalition.
What's the most powerful political office in the world? It is not the President of the United States. It's precinct committeemen. Why? There's three main reasons. First, because precinct committeemen and only precinct committeemen get to elect the leaders of the political parties. If you want to elect the leadership of one of the two major political parties in this country, then you have to become a precinct committeeman.
There you go. And, other reasons that the precinct committee people get to choose who are the primary candidates. And I got a couple more clips that lay this out, but you get the idea. The precinct committee people get to decide who are the primary candidates, and so if you put four Tea Partiers up for the primary, guess what? A Tea Party is going to be the person who goes into the general election, number one. And number two, the precinct committee people get to write the party's position papers. They write the party platform. And so, hey, you can do it too. So I would submit that, big money and a really good organized effort did in 2010 to get the Tea Party into Congress could be done to get more progressives into Congress as well. And you just need to, share that wisdom with your friends. Dave in St. Charles, Missouri. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm in Arizona, Tom, but I wanted to call and ask if someone smarter than I am could give a reason why we could not use the Equal Protection Clause in regards to redistricting. It seems to me that some of these districts, especially in purple states, are so convoluted to keep the majority. I read that there were 20 million more Democratic votes, even with nobody showing up, than there were Republican votes, yet the Republicans won all the seats.
Yeah, it was actually in the House of Representatives, it was 5 million. In the Senate, it was 20 million. The Democrats got 5 million more votes. What's your rationale for using the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause? This is, for people who don't know, after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed. The 13th Amendment outlawed slavery. The 14th Amendment said everybody has access to the courts. No one shall be denied due process under the law, equal access to due process under the law. And the third one made it possible for former slaves to vote, the 15th Amendment. So how do we use the 14th Amendment to take down gerrymandering? I don't get it, Dave.
Well, it seems to me that especially the reasoning behind most of the gerrymandering and redistricting is to keep black people from voting.
Oh, no, it's not. Actually, back in 2010, there were a couple of Republicans who were quoted on this, saying this out loud. What they said they wanted to do was put a black face on the Democratic Party. So what they're doing is they're creating majority Democratic districts, and whenever possible, they're making sure that those districts are also majority black so that they will elect an African-American to Congress, so that when increasingly over time, as time goes on, when people look at the Democrats in Congress, they'll see a large number of people of color. And, of course, you know what that does to Southern white Fox News viewers.
That's despicable.
Yeah.
That's despicable.
I agree. I agree. And, they're creating basically, there's only, I think, 12 out of 435 House seats for the House of Representatives. There are only 12 or 14 of them now that are what's called competitive, where you really don't know, going into the election, whether the Republican or the Democrat is going to win. And pretty much all the rest of them, it's whoever is the nominee of the party, whoever ends up, winning that primary, depending on whether it's a red district or a blue district, they're going to win the election. And
right, that's my point. It seems like to me that it would be.
We need to fix it. No, I'm with you, Dave. And California did fix it. What they did was they passed, and this, I believe it was a citizen initiative, they passed a law in California that said that congressional districts in California cannot be drawn with any consideration of politics. They put together a nonpartisan kind of technocrat board who does these things, and the goal is to always get the district to be basically a polygon as much as possible, even sides. And the result of that is that California has one of the best functioning political systems in the United States right now as a consequence. Dave, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard. Benghazi?
Hello. Yeah. I read about a week ago or 2 weeks ago about this guy, this Republican running the committee.
Trey Gowdy.
That he had been excluding. Yeah, Trey Gowdy, kind of a guy that needs to be investigated. And Elijah Cummings was mentioned that, they had interviewed a bunch of people that they had found actually some of these people, and excluding the Democrats without even letting them know. And he got wind of it, and that some of the stuff that was being uncovered by the Republicans, they were the Democrats were able to find out were exculpatory towards what happened. In other words, they were finding it wasn't supporting the Republican side.
Right. It actually made Hillary Clinton look good.
Yes. So the question is, this is clearly a political setup, because why isn't the committee really working right now? They're waiting. They're slowing it down so that it comes online in time for the next election. So.
Right.
Our government is being used by the Republicans for their own benefit, not for the people's as a whole. They're turning our government to their purposes only.
Yes.
And my question is, and I wish Bernie was still on, is because he was in the House, isn't there a way to, isn't there some sort of an ethics violation? Even, why aren't the Democrats bringing it up? This guy is clearly.
I think Elijah Cummings is halfway there. He is seriously PO'd about this. And not just Trey Gowdy, but also Daryl Issa, his behavior before that with the whole, Benghazi thing. So we'll see, Richard. It is possible. But bringing ethics violations, charges against another member of the House is a real difficult thing for any member to do.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's not difficult because it's a hard process. It's difficult because you instantly alienate a lot of people and they'll never, ever trust you again. Welcome back. Mike in Palmer, Alaska. Hey, Mike, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
It's anything goes. All the years I've been listening to your program, I've never heard anyone mention the 16th Amendment.
Oh, I've talked about the 16th Amendment.
And the way it was actually ratified was the biggest fraud ever perpetrated on the American peoples. But I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure. Well, the 16th Amendment is the amendment that makes possible personal income tax and creates the IRS, essentially. And it was pushed through in the dark of night on just before Christmas Eve. And there is to this day an assertion that this amendment to the Constitution which is the ultimate law, I mean, it's the top law of the land, didn't actually have enough votes in the House or Senate to pass. I forget which it was, and I believe the argument is that they were actually one vote short. But the president signed it into law. I think it was Wilson president back then, or I forget who was president. Yeah, but I'd have to go back and look. But, you know, whether that's true or not, it's sort of like, you know, in 1886, the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, the Supreme Court did not rule that corporations are people. In fact, the opposite. If you read that case all the way to the end, you'll see Stephen Field wrote a dissent in which he said, I'm very disappointed that my proposal that corporations are people was not agreed upon. And in the decision itself, in the majority opinion, it comes right to the end and it says, you know, there were several constitutional issues argued by the parties in this case, but because we were able to find the remedy under the laws of California, there's no need to examine constitutional issues. But still, if you look at Citizens United or you go back to Buckley versus, or you go back to First National Bank versus Bilotti, et cetera, you will find the justices citing that case. So, It's like the reality of what happened is not as important as the reality that, hey, it's here. The president actually did sign that into law. So whether it, you know, whether that final vote was there or not, I don't know. But you're not going to get the 16th Amendment knocked down. And why would you want to? I mean, you know, the income tax is one of the fairer taxes that we have, frankly. It's one of the more appropriate and reasonable ways to collect the revenue that we need to keep our government running. Now, say that again. Oh, the president doesn't sign amendments. Okay, thank you. I thought when you said that, that's what you were saying. I misunderstood. In fact, I'd misspoken before that, wasn't it? You were correcting me. Thank you, Shane. So anyhow, the net of this is you know, you've got some cranky billionaires who don't like paying income taxes, and some, you know, other people in the top 1% who are seeing their tax rates go up to 25% if they're getting capital gains, or 39% if they're making a lot of money. And they're saying, oh, yeah, let's get rid of the IRS. Let's not pay taxes. So they want to do away with the 16th Amendment, and they're trying to find some little hole for it. But, you know, if you're an average working person, the 16th Amendment is working to your benefit because it is, you know, collecting more money from really, really rich people who can afford to pay that money than it is from you. And you know, that some of that money, there is some wealth redistribution in the United States, and it's being used to give you tax credits and to pay for public universities and all kinds of good stuff. So, you know, I'm just not concerned about the 16th Amendment being constitutional, unconstitutional, legal, appropriate or not. It's here. We've got it. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And over at goatsfortheoldgoat.com, you can still get those Swarovski crystal necklaces that are made by, crystal hearts that are made by women who saw people killed in front of them in South Sudan. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I see you are in the basement of the White House. What's going
on? I am.
In the what is it, the vault of secrecy or silence? Superman's
silence
place?
Today, actually, yes, because the president's on his way to Indiana, where he's going to be holding a town hall. He's going to be talking about his plan for free community college.
Right. That should be interesting.
Should be interesting in a red state, yes.
Yeah. Mike Pence will not be happy, but hey.
Well.
What can you say?
A statement attributed to ISIS today claims that an American female hostage was killed in a Jordanian airstrike sometime around midday today, probably, because they claim that it happened during Muslim prayers, in airstrikes that targeted the same location for more than an hour, they claim, on the outskirts of the northern city in Syria of Raqqa, which is the extremist group's main stronghold. They also claim that no ISIS militants were killed in these airstrikes, which they claim lasted for about an hour. They identify the woman as Kayla Jean Mueller. She's the first time that she's been identified. They published photos, allegedly, of the bomb site, which shows a severely damaged brown-colored three-story building, but they've not published any photos or images of the woman. The American officials say they're looking into the report. The White House said it doesn't have immediate comment. The Jordanian government says it's another PR stunt and they're trying to put a wedge between the coalition, seeing as they haven't been able to put a wedge between the Jordanian people. It is a fascinating coincidence that as soon as the Jordanians start bombing them directly, gosh, the very second day, they managed to take out the only female hostage being held.
Right, and an American.
No ISIS militants.
Yeah, and ISIS, I mean, all they are is a PR machine, and that's why it was so, in my mind, obscene that Fox News put a 20-minute ISIS propaganda video up on their website. And but that's a whole nother
thing. They got a lot of views.
I'm sure.
They got a lot of views.
And it's wrong.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. So we'll see. This woman may, of course, be dead.
Yeah, and she might have been dead for 2 months.
She might have been dead for some time. So we just don't know. She's a 26-year-old humanitarian aid worker from Prescott, Arizona. She'd been working in Turkey assisting Syrian refugees. She said to her local newspaper, the Daily Courier, "For as long as I live, I will not let this suffering be normal. It's important to stop and realize what we have, why we have it, and how privileged we are, and from that place start caring and get a lot done."
Wow. Wow. Sounds like a really great human being.
Yes. Yes. The January jobs report came out this morning from the Labor Department, and it was predicted that they would add about 230,000 new jobs, but they topped that. 257,000 jobs were added in January. Also, the unemployment rate ticked up 0.1% to 5.7% as the improving job market lured more Americans into the workforce. This has excited economists and outlets such as the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg, not only because of that, but also because average hourly earnings jumped 0.5%, the most since November 2008 from the prior month. Mm. So they're quite pleased about this. They're also seeing that the job gains in January were led by retailers, construction firms, healthcare companies. So now what they're looking at is, what is this going to cause the Fed to do? The thinking by some is that it could cause them to raise interest rates in June.
Right, which we've seen already reflected in bond prices.
Right.
Bond rates going up, bond fund values going down.
Right. Interesting developments in the Southern District of New York yesterday in a courtroom. Judge Alvin Hellerstein is demanding that the government explain photo by photo why it cannot release about 2,100 photographs showing detainee abuse by U.S. forces at military prison sites in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Hmm.
The judge appeared skeptical of the government's argument, which asserted that the threat of ISIS and Al-Qaeda exploiting the images for propaganda should override the public's right to see any of the photos. He was, quote, highly suspicious of the government's attempt to declare the whole lot of the photos dangerous. It's too easy and too meaningless, he said.
Mm. Yeah.
So they've basically given the government about a week to come back to him, and he's also told them, really, don't dawdle and don't appeal.
Which agency is this? DOD?
This is the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. This is the Pentagon.
Very interesting.
Yeah, the ACLU has been trying to get these photos since 2004.
Wow.
An Israeli official today criticized House Speaker John Boehner for inviting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to speak before a joint session of Congress without talking to the White House.
Oh, so before they were trying to vilify Obama, now they're vilifying Boehner. They're going to have a lot of friends left.
Well, it was an interesting statement by Deputy Israeli Foreign Minister Tzaki Henegbi. He told a Tel Aviv radio station, "It appears that the Speaker of Congress made a move in which we trusted, but which it ultimately became clear was a one-sided move and not a move by both sides."
Yeah. Ron Dermer is such a partisan Republican hack, respectfully, and he's a protege of Frank Luntz. I mean, he's the Israeli ambassador to the United States,
yes.
And he was, you know, he's an American. He grew up in Miami Beach. I mean,
and he met on Wednesday with seven Democratic Jewish lawmakers
who read him the Riot Act.
Read him the Riot Act. The meeting was led by Stephen Israel. One of them, apparently, according to people in the room, even said to him that it was disingenuous, probably using a polite term, for him to say, particularly since he'd been born in America, that he didn't expect this response.
Right, right. Not just born in America. I mean, he's a protege of Frank Luntz. It's amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful weekend, Victoria. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour is the third hour of our program. It's Anything Goes Friday. We've been talking about a few things that we have been covering here so far. One of them is that I have not riffed on, and I want to right now very briefly, and then we'll pick up your calls, is this growing meme, this growing thought virus on the part of the Reich that Islamic terrorism is this great threat to the world, and that President Obama, by refusing to call these terrorists Islamic terrorists, is somehow failing to acknowledge the real problem. Now, this is not only a talking point from the Republicans, it's even, you know, there have even been some progressives saying this. I would like to remind you that Hitler had his own official church. Bishop Mueller was elevated to being he was the Reichsbishop. He was the head of the German church. It was a Protestant, you know. Bishop Mueller, I believe, had been a Catholic bishop. I'm not. Maybe he was Protestant, but anyhow, Hitler made him number one. And after World War II, at the end of the war, when Bishop Mueller saw what had happened in the name of Nazism, he committed suicide. But Hitler constantly invoked Jesus. Did anybody refer to the Nazis as Christian terrorists? For example? I mean, we had General Boykin out there talking about my God is bigger than their God back in 2002, 2003 when we were invading Iraq and Afghanistan. I guarantee you that some of those folks that, you know, whose country we invaded and whose families we killed think of us as Christian terrorists. But here's the thing. By not putting a religion with the word terrorist, President Obama is doing something very sophisticated and very smart. And these idiots at Fox so-called News and on the right-wing hate radio who are all bent out of shape about the fact that the president will not say Islamic terrorists are so wrong. And here's why. When you call them terrorists, when you call them criminals, you are correctly identifying who they are and what they are. and you are stripping from them the ability to claim that there's a rationale for their behavior. I mean, if you think that their behavior is secular, that they're just trying to stop people from invading their country, you call them freedom fighters, right? Or rebels. And in fact, there was some reasonable reporting that was done during our occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, where reporters would occasionally refer to the people who are coming after our soldiers as rebels, as separatists, as, you know, things that talked about their ultimate goal, as opposed to simply enemy or terrorists. But the ones who are, you know, in particular Boko Haram and ISIS, the ones who are using the name of one of the world's great religions to justify their action, when we go along with that, which is what Fox News is doing, Fox News, you know, ISIS put in a mind-boggling amount of effort and time and money into creating a 20-minute propaganda video that included the murder of, by burning him to death, of the Jordanian pilot. Now, our government has chosen not to show that video. We don't, I mean, the ISIS created a PR video. This is their public relations work. This is their propaganda. So we said, you know, as a government, we said, no, we're not going to put that out there. And NBC looked at this and said, no, no way, we're not going to run this. We are not shills for ISIS. ABC looked at it and said, no, we're not shills for ISIS. We will not put this up. CBS looked at it and said, no, we're not shills for ISIS. CNN, MSNBC, no, we're not going to shill for ISIS. We're not going to do their public relations work. They put a lot of work into this video. They want people to see it. We are not going to help them make that happen. And then comes Fox so-called news. And Roger Ailes makes the decision, hey, let's put it on our website and let's show it on the air, or at least a good chunk of it. Now, why would he do that? Why would Fox do what ISIS wants? Well, I would submit to you that it's the exact same reason why George W. Bush did what bin Laden wanted. Bin Laden was attempting, his famous letter where he said, all I have to do is just wave the flag of Al-Qaeda and Bush is so stupid he'll send troops halfway across the world. And he literally was calling out George W. Bush. He's, this guy will do anything I tell him to, which was true. The last thing bin Laden wanted would have been to have been treated as a criminal by saying that he was the head of an Islamic band of terror. I mean, you elevate him. You give him credibility. You give a patina of rationale to what he's doing. These guys are thugs. They're criminals. They're not Islamic anything any more than Hitler's Nazis were Christian anything. But Fox so-called news and the right, I mean, I've had now three right-wingers as guests on this program and on radio program and on television and on my TV show where they have said, well, you know, so-and-so seems more concerned about Islamic terrorism or Islamic radicalism than Obama. You know, which is the Fox News way of saying Obama's not going to use those words. Well, he's not going to use those words because those are the words that they want him to use. But, you know, trust Fox so-called news not to understand that and their viewers not to understand that. And the result of this, Fox so-called news doing the work of ISIS. By the way, interesting study here. This is from Headlines in Global News. The headline, meditation may help reduce age-related gray mass reduction in the brain. We're talking about gray matter. It's, you know, part of your brain. Those who meditated, they took two groups of people from 24 to 77 years of age. Those who meditated had been doing so for 4 to 46 years with an average of 20 years. People in both groups showed a loss of gray matter with age. But those who meditated had a higher volume of gray matter than counterparts who did not regularly meditate. Time to start meditating. Remember yesterday or the day before we were talking about how 30,000 people showed up in downtown Dublin, Ireland to march against the privatization of their water supply? One of the things that the EU and the World Bank and the IMF, I don't know if the World Bank is involved in this, but the EU and the IMF are shoving down the throat of Ireland is you guys are in debt and you got to pay in euros because you accepted the euro and you don't have any euros to give us. So you've got to sell off some of your publicly owned stuff. Like, let's start with your water company. People in Ireland don't even have water meters on their homes. Water has always been considered a right. Water is provided by the state. It is free. And so the EU is, and the, you know, the technocrats, the basically conservative ideologues, economic ideologues at the EU and IMF are telling the Irish, you got to privatize this. 30,000 Irish showed up in the streets of Dublin to protest it. They're protesting it all over the country. They're all up in arms about it. And while that is happening here in the United States, you would think that we would be politically sophisticated and know what's going on. Here's the headline. New Jersey Governor Christie signs bill siding with private water companies over public water. Chris Christie just signed a piece of legislation in New Jersey allowing private corporations to come in. It's fast-tracked, right? They're blowing up due process. Local communities can't even fight this, allowing private corporations to come in and buy up their water systems and run them for a profit. This is nuts. This is just plain old flat-out nuts. This is the slow and steady. And by the way, who's going to buy these water systems in New Jersey? Probably foreigners, because our trade policies shipped all our money to them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls here on Anything Goes Friday. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ricky watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Ricky, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
All these different issues I've been listening to today that, and over the past, it seems forever, I think with Senator Sanders, this PAC money, the Supreme Court ruling, I think it is one of the biggest issues that we have facing us as American citizens, because if it takes away our, if it suppresses our vote in this country to the point to where we feel our vote, we already feel our vote doesn't count in some ways. If this goes through to where this money gets a hold, a put hold more so in the door of this voting election in this country, we're doomed. It's over. Could you comment on that and the different scenarios of how this could play out throughout your programs? Because I'm really interested in it. This is my main concern.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ricky. Thanks for the call. You have to understand where this started. There have been a couple of times in our history where bribery of public officials was pretty naked. In the late 1900s, Copper Country, I think it was Montana, wherever the Anaconda copper mine is, it used to be named something else. And the guy who owned it, I think his name was Miller, but it's been a while since I did the story about this guy. He wanted to become a United States senator. And this was back in the day when United States senators were appointed by the state legislature. So he stood outside the state legislature and said, I've got in my pocket a bunch of envelopes, and each one has a $10,000 bill in it. And anybody who votes for me as a United States senator, I'll give you $10,000 on, you know, as you walk out. And they elected him to be their senator, and he passed out his $10,000 bills. William Clark was his name. Thank you, Shano. And the United States Congress was so horrified by this that they refused to seat him. Although after a couple of weeks, they gave in and he did become the senator from, was it Oklahoma, Shannon? Yeah, Montana. There we go. And he became the senator from Montana. So we cleaned that up. In 1907, Congress passed the Tillman Act, which said that, you know, it's a federal crime for anyone to give money to somebody running for a political office. And then on top of that, you know, in addition to the Tillman Act, there have been this whole series of electoral reforms over the years. You know, the reforms in 73 after Nixon, McCain-Feingold in the late 90s, a whole bunch of pieces of legislation that basically put some rational control over the spending of money. Spending of money had always been considered a regulatable behavior. But in 1976, the Supreme Court ruled that, no, the spending of money for politics is actually speech. It was a case called Buckley versus Vallejo. And the next year, in the case called Buckley, you know, the First National Bank versus Bilotti, they ruled that, by the way, corporations have this right too. So It's the old sneeze machine here. So, and then in 2010, with Citizens United, 5 years ago, they brought these decisions together, put the thing on steroids, and said, you know, hey, anybody can buy any politicians they want. The best way to push this back, to push back on this, to roll this back, is to amend the Constitution, to say that the Supreme Court was wrong, that spending money is not speech, and that corporations are not people. And, it, you know, you go to movetoamend.org. And once that is done, once the Supreme Court has been put in a cage, has been restrained, then I guarantee you both Democrats and Republicans will vote to regulate money in politics because they're all sick of spending half their time fundraising. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Barb, driving through Illinois and listening to Sirius. Hey, Barb, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to say thanks for taking my call. I learn so much from you every day.
Thank you.
I just recently was made aware of this new Big Brother program, so to speak, in the insurance agencies. And I don't know if you're aware of it or not. It's called Comprehensive Loss Underwriters Exchange.
Never heard of it.
And basically what it's doing is if there was ever a claim, whether you were at fault or not, whether you were in an accident or and or also with your homeowners, now kicks you up into this higher tax premium bracket. Your insurance agent will not tell you about this, but it is there. And unless you're aware of it, it's kind of like a credit report, so to speak.
Right.
And their whole thing is if you were ever in an accident, well, you're that much more chances to being in another one, whether it was your fault or not.
Wow.
And in other words, basically just taking more and more money away from everybody else. I just
right. It's just another rationale to jack up profits.
Absolutely. And I was so appalled by it. I was moved to call and tell somebody.
Yeah. Well, this is something that if everybody listening in every state in the union was to call the insurance commissioner for their state, and the office for the insurance commissioner is in your phone book, or you can easily find it online, that would be a good starting point to find out what's going on in your state with regard to CLUE, this Comprehensive Loss Underwriting Exchange, and if it's going to allow the insurance companies to further abuse you, or if the insurance commissioner is doing something about it.
It just started in January, and then they will go back 7 years. And like I said, whether you were ever at fault or not.
Now, is this just for auto insurance?
No, it's also for homeowners insurance.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah,
the industry, I mean, they're tightening up their underwriting standards and trying to reduce their risk. And if that means that their product is not as valuable or as useful, guess who gets the short end of that stick? It's us. Barb, thanks for that. I'll have to keep an eye out for it. I appreciate the heads up. Doris in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Doris. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm so privileged to be in your company.
Well, thank you.
I originally called today because I am disturbed that the legislature and – or it's not even legislature. It's the county. They are going to – make voting centralized, all right?
In Ohio?
And that means people, they're like guaranteeing people 2.5 miles in their voting district. But that, I think what that says is that we automatically, we think people have a car, right?
Right, right.
So they're not.
Is it easy to get a ballot in the mail in Ohio, Doris?
That's a great question.
Yeah, because that's one of the ways that this kind of thing gets gotten around. And you know, in Washington State, they started out with a lot of making it very easy for people to ask for an absentee ballot, and then that worked so well that they just rolled over, I believe, to vote by mail like they've got in Oregon, and in Colorado, I believe the same thing is happening. So that's a pressure point that undoes that assumption that you must have a car to vote. If you can easily get a ballot in the mail, that's one. The other one is weekend voting. Whether they've extended voting hours. And I know that they've been dialing back on that because it's very popular in the African American community, and the white Republicans who run Ohio don't want that. Don't want those folks voting. But
The other thing that you like started off on the hour about was about, I am so nervous.
That's okay, Doris.
Terribly lost.
Yeah. Doris, I'm going to have to ask you to call back, you know, another time for your second question. But thank you for the call, and thanks for the kind comments and for bringing up a really important topic. Richard in Duluth, Minnesota. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Oh, Tom, it's an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
I was going to say, as mentioned, a minimum wage. I started working in 1964. I made $1.25 an hour. I could go to a bank. I could get a silver dollar and a silver quarter with the weight of almost an ounce of silver.
In 64?
Yeah.
Huh.
Then Lyndon Johnson, in 1965, signed the Coinage Act.
Right.
And he said at the time, I watched it on YouTube, he says, yeah, we'll still have a lot of silver in circulation. And at that time, you know, a postage stamp was 3 cents.
Right.
You could buy 5 pounds of hamburger for $1.25. And it just seems to me that was really a blow to the economy when all that silver disappeared. I wonder what happened to it. And I'm curious about the politics. Who are the big players in that one? I've never heard that discussed.
I think that what was going on, if you'll recall, the Hunt brothers had tried to, you know, a couple of Texas billionaires had tried to corner the silver market, and they jacked the price of silver from, you know, under $1 an ounce to, as I recall, over $10 an ounce. And I think that was in the 60s, and it would make a lot of sense if it was, that would be why LBJ would say, okay, we're going to stop making our coins out of silver. Where that silver went, for a lot of years, you could buy, it was called junk silver. You'd buy a bag, you know, $1,000 face value bag, you know, would cost you maybe $5,000 or $6,000, or, you know, $100 with a face value. You could buy it for a couple hundred bucks. And you're basically just buying the silver value, you know, of coins, of quarters and dimes. And my dad had some. I mean, he was a coin collector. And I don't think that, I mean, that had nothing to do with a gold standard or silver standard. It just had to do with what our coins are made out of and what they look like. I really don't think that that had any impact on things like inflation, if that's where you're going. Richard, thank you for the call. And thanks for the history lesson or history reminder or both. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with more of your calls, your thoughts, my thoughts, the news of the day right here on the Tom Harmon Program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. By the way, my new book, Death in the Pines. Check it out. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on your media support group for We the People, what is left of our Democratic Republic. Oh, my. We live in interesting times. We're actually very blessed to be living at this time. Bruce in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hey, Dr. Hartman. Good Friday to you. Thank you for taking my call, as always.
Thank you.
One quick aside before I get to my question. Watching the show Brain Games on National Geographic Channel recently, interesting show. They were before the commercial break, they posed a question to the audience, and one of the questions was, in the past 5,000 years, has the human brain shrank 10%, grown 10%, or remained the same? And the answer was, it has shrunk 10% over the past 5,000 years. And the brainiacs who say this speculate the reason is because that our hunter-gatherer ancestors needed a larger toolkit of survival skills, which after 5,000 years when we settled down, didn't need anymore. So I thought that was an interesting bit of geeky science trivia.
Okay. I've not heard that, Bruce. The brain size thing that I do know about is that the average modern human, Homo sapiens sapiens, is, I think, either 14 or 1500 cc's is the size of our brains, and that of Neanderthals was 1600 cc's. They actually had bigger brains. Yeah.
Yes, that is true. That I did know.
Yeah, that's.
That was just a quick aside. I just thought it was rather interesting. I'll throw it out there. My question was concerning President Teddy Roosevelt and his trust busting. Mm-hmm. I was watching that Ken Burns thing on the Roosevelts, and one interesting point they brought up was that during the time when there was this huge mine owner conflict. The President Roosevelt brought the mine owners and the mine labor leaders to the White House and said, "Y'all going to have to figure this out. Y'all going to sit down and figure out some kind of agreement." The mine owners, of course, said, "No, we are not. We refuse to because we don't have to." And so we're going to continue to do business the way we do it. And President Teddy's response was, "Well, if you don't, then I'm going to nationalize the mines. I'm going to call in the military, and they're going to take control and manage the mines from here on out." Their response, the miners' response was, "You can't do that. You don't have the right. You don't have the constitutional authority." His response was, "I know that, but I'm going to do it anyway." I said, "Because I have the moral duty and responsibility to the American people, which essentially trumps anything that the Constitution has to say about the issue." My question to you is, did he do the right thing, or did he overstep his boundaries? Did he do the very wrong thing for the very right reasons? Your response.
It sounds, Bruce,
to have done that.
Bruce, this is a piece of TR history, Teddy Roosevelt history, that I'm not familiar with, so I can't. You know, I can't make any kind of definitive statement on this. If it's exactly the way that you characterized it, it sounds to me like he did the right thing for the right reason. And by acknowledging that he didn't have the authority or the power to do that, I think that makes it even more right.
Huh. Because it appears that they stepped down and, you know, they stood down and made some sort of agreement with,
yeah,
with the.
Well, it was just like when Franklin Roosevelt went after the Supreme Court and they backed down ultimately without having the nature of the court changed. But, you know, just because something is against the law doesn't mean that it's the wrong thing. You know, when Martin Luther King was marching, they were breaking laws. They were breaking public gathering laws, loitering laws, laws that were written specifically to prevent, by and large, African Americans from gathering into groups. I mean, they were breaking the law. That's the essence of nonviolent resistance is to break the law in a way that is nonviolent, and yet it was the right thing, and it was the right thing to do. So, you know, just because the rules are there, if Teddy Roosevelt got the result that you're saying he did, then it seems to me like it was a good thing, a right thing. Anyhow, Bruce, I gotta move along, and I'm sorry I can't, you know, make a definitive comment on that, because I just, like I said, I didn't know that story. Tom in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Tom, you wanted to talk about the New York Times and 9/11?
Yes, Tom. I need a moral or uplifting or pickup here. I'm 72 years old, a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. I just had left just before the big riots started, had graduated just before the riots started in 67 against DuPont, when the students and the professors were beaten by the Madison Police Department. And over the years, I heard yesterday on CNN, I had your CNN on before your show started, and they actually broadcast this thing about Massawi's admission or confession that the Saudi Arabian government and the ambassador, but the royal and the royalists involved here, had funded the 9/11 attacks, and I was very surprised to hear this on CNN, and. So I can't listen to all the channels, but I started switching the channels, and then I switched to NBC last night, and of course nothing on there. It's all the talk is about Brian Williams and measles, and that's all it was all day long, and that jet went to
ISIS.
Taiwan.
Yeah.
So what my question is that's where it hit me in the face. None of the major news, and I think this is the New York Times, I think the New York Post also had it, but I knew it about 3 or 4 months back, and I think you had even mentioned something to this effect.
Oh, yeah.
I just say, I can't figure out how can we get in the 60s when I was in the university and had just gotten out of the university, when all the riots started to take place, when the young students started marching on Washington, and I have those videos of all of that stuff. I don't know how we can do that again and get that, because the mainstream will not broadcast this. And I know it's the corporations have just channeled the media. We have to, you know, if you're going to follow the thing, follow the money. And, you know, I know this was a complete farce. I know about Mickey Herkesowitz's book on Bush's autobiography. And I know the 9/11 Commission's report, Omissions and Distortions by David Ray Griffin, which is entirely footnoted. About a third of the book is all footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, how, and then yet people will go to see American Sniper, drew more money the last 2 weeks than any other show, and they're so, you know, taken by the film, but I'm so taken by that, you know, they don't really know the story. We keep doing the same thing over, and I don't know. I know you're preaching to the choir for most of the time, but I don't know how to get more people involved. I dropped cable TV so that I could get free speech TV and Al Jazeera, and I didn't hear anything on Al Jazeera about it either yesterday.
Wow.
But my question is what, I don't know. I'm just in the dumps. I was able to march back in the Vietnam days, but I just don't see anybody in being involved and wanting to do anything.
There are a lot of people, Tom, who are involved. I mean, we had the climate march a few months ago. You had 2 million people around the world. You had 300,000 people show up in New York City. There were people showing up in cities all over the country. In the previous world record for people showing up was in the winter of 2002-2003, when millions of people showed up in the streets all over the world protesting the possibility that George W. Bush might start bombing Iraq. He went ahead and did it anyway. But, you know, there are a lot of activists out there, and there are a lot of great groups, you know, from Occupy to the Women in Black to you know, I mean, there's just a bunch of them. So the Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, is doing incredible work, you know, building an inside-outside machine where they're working with legislators, and yet at the same time they're becoming a really significant pressure group on the outside. I would suggest that you go to pdamerica.org and see what they're up to, and see if there's some way you could pitch in, because there is so much that can be done, Tom. There really is. So, yeah, I agree. We've got some real challenges with our media. We have a corporate-controlled media, and they're only going to talk about the things that are the corporate agenda. So you're not going to hear about, you know, TPP on any of the big corporate media. You're not going to hear about net neutrality on any of the big corporate media, at least not an honest discussion about it. Hopefully you will hear it here, but, you know, not those other places. But that doesn't mean that we still have to do the best we can. So Tom, I got to move along, but thank you for the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Linda in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Linda, you wanted to correct something about the Clue report?
Yeah, I'm an independent insurance agent here in Madison, Wisconsin, and Clue reports have been being used in the insurance industry for probably 15 years.
Uh-huh.
It's not something that's always considered a detriment to somebody. It is a way for us to conduct underwriting, just like we would pull your motor vehicle record or, you know, other underwriting tools that we use.
Right.
Her particular company may have just started using a Clue report, and my suggestion to her is if they are, you know, affecting her rate for something that she deems is not her fault, that she should probably, you know, shop her insurance around and talk to an independent agent in her area, because there's lots of companies and lots of competition, and every company does their underwriting slightly differently.
Right.
But I just wanted to let you know that the Clue is nothing new.
Okay, so the clue is basically it's like your credit score to a bank. This is your accident score to an insurance company.
It's not even an accident score. It just simply lists, like, you know, let's say, like, April 3rd, 2011, you had a hail claim payout of $10,000.
Uh-huh.
So it just lets us know, like, okay, this person had a hail loss.
Right.
You know, was it repaired? Was it, you know, how was the roof? You know, just kind of, it's just an underwriting tool, essentially.
Right. Very interesting. Okay, Linda, thank you. Thank you for that. 15 years. Wow. That's a while. I appreciate the call. And once again, Linda, you have proven this program has the smartest listeners in the country. It is just a continuous amazement to me. Thank you for setting us all straight. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if I may remind you of two events, The Crash of 2016 just came out in paperback, and my newest book, Death in the Pines, just came out. Welcome back. Joanne in West Bend, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Joanne, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thank God for Progressive Talk Radio. I'm deep in red country here in Walker territory.
Yeah.
And I just happened to be in Madison the Tuesday after Act 10 broke by accident, and saw how Walker had responded with the National Guard, and I couldn't even get to where I was trying to get to. But anyway, during the whole recall process and stuff, I noticed that I was trying to figure out why Scott Walker could not address Wisconsinites directly, and it was a totally peaceful march. I, too, that Tom, the other caller that you had, the other gentleman that just called in,
yeah,
I graduated in 1970 from high school, and I witnessed the Madison and the State Street riots and Kent State riots and stuff, and it was extremely violent. And people here in Wisconsin believed that the protests in Madison were violent, and it aggravated Walker to no extent that they weren't, that there were no laws being broken. So he had to close the Capitol for cleaning, supposedly, and only showed people climbing in to the Capitol, trying to get in to to the our Capitol. And but anyway, in the process, he made it a law that we could not. If two or more want to assemble in the Capitol for any kind of protesting purposes, you have to get their permission.
Right.
You have to do it. Walker has to give us permission to protest against him. Anyway, the one night I Googled, Walker was in Texas during that whole first week, out in Arizona, New Jersey, and Texas. And I thought, why is Walker spending so much time in Texas? And then I started thinking George Walker Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. Is there any connection?
In the process,
I discovered that there was Neil and Marvin Bush.
Right.
And this is my question. I saw American Sniper because my husband is totally into all of that.
Mm.
So in my process of trying to discover whether or not Scott Walker had any connection with the Bush family, I wonder if this is true. I don't want to tell it if it isn't. I discovered that Neil and Marvin Bush were CEOs of the security system for the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
That was just Neil, and it was just the World Trade Center, and he quit that job a year before 9/11.
It was a year before 9/11.
Yes. Yeah, he was nowhere in the neighborhood when 9/11 happened. And it was just the World Trade Center. And I'm not even sure it was the whole building, but, you know, he was involved with that company. And his involvement was not hands-on. He didn't work in New York City. He didn't have anything to do with the building. He was just an executive or a senior stockholder or a member of the board of the company that got that contract. So it's not quite the neat little conspiracy theory that it seems. Joanne, thank you for the call. By the way, if you want to look up Neil Bush, look up Silverado. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Davinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the companies and organizations that syndicate this program, Westwood One on commercial radio, Pacifica on non-commercial radio, Sirius XM satellite radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable carriers that carry our show, including Manhattan Neighborhood Network. all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, hey, to Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliated radio and television stations, our sponsors and underwriters, and to you for supporting our program and supporting our podcasts. Thank you so much. It's really appreciated. Without you, we would not be here. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff. Vaccines?
Hi. First, actually, I wanted the Hunt brothers. Their silver manipulation was in the 70s, and Silver Thursday was in 1980, the famous collapse.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Anyway, about vaccines, just like there's a dentist you and I talked to once who was afraid of speaking of fluoride, the doubts about fluoride. And I know many dentists who won't speak up because they get pilloried when they speak up.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who question, you know, the vaccine question is not so black and white as many people make it. And so a lot of people just question things about vaccines, are actually afraid to speak up because they get pilloried.
Yeah.
But and they're very scientific people. Actually, I'd say a lot of the pro-vaccine people are less scientific than a lot of these other people. But the problem that a lot of people question vaccines have is actually the schedule and the combination of things. One of my friends, now, I come from a family who has been affected directly by things such as polio, you know, multiple mm-hmm. members of my family.
Sure.
And so I know the problems these things can, you know, bring on. But the problem is combining vaccines. So I was saying this one friend, he got a yellow fever and a Japanese B encephalitis vaccine together, and he can barely walk anymore. It's really hard for him to stand up.
Whoa.
And also just even normal vaccines going into things like pets. A dog across the street got a rabies vaccine within hours, had severe reaction and was crippled for years and, you know, died very young because of mm-hmm. that. So there are reactions to vaccines, and also then there's the effectiveness. If you look at Dr. Gregor Poland, who's the editor of Vaccine, and also the Mayo Clinic's leader of the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group, he talks about, you know, problems with vaccines, and the effectiveness of vaccines is questionable to a certain extent. It's like the outbreak in 2011 in Canada of measles. 50% mm-hmm. of the people who got measles, the children, had gotten the double dose of the measles vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just not so black and white. Anyway, there are good reasons for vaccines, but it's not that, you know, vaccines are not totally innocent by yep. any means.
I'm kind of haunted by what I've read. I assume that it's true that Japan has outlawed the MMR vaccine, but they do make measles, mumps, and rubella available as single individual shots. So you yep. don't have that combination. It's most of the horror stories I've heard have been around MMR, but you know, who knows?
Combinations in general, and then yeah. it's like also lack of long-term studies. There are people, perhaps even myself, that have been affected decades later because of the live polio vaccine.
Right.
But we have not really done good science to follow these things. Oftentimes, vaccine studies, you know, look at immediate effects or effects within like 3 months, and yeah. then oftentimes there is just as it's always the case, you know, in our, we find in medicine, we've got to be very careful because of bias of the studies done by the people who tend to profit from, you know, a good outcome of the study.
Yeah. Yeah. At the same time, you know, the public health is pretty important. So.
Oh, yes. Well, that's the thing is we need to look at good science. And
yeah.
I think there's a lot of bad science. I mean, just like for years we said, hey, we need to you should take aspirin to prevent heart attacks.
Hmm.
Well, now we just suddenly flip that over. We said avoid fat for years.
Right.
Now we say it's carbohydrates,
it's
not
sugars.
Fat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Good points on all, Jeff. Thank you for calling and making them. Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike. Scott Walker?
Yes. You know, and my heart goes out to Linda in West Bend, which is Glenn Grossman country, U.S. congressman, freshman that is very, very stale. And also to Tom, but, you know, the right thing for the right reason. We still have things that we can do in Wisconsin, and Scott Walker overstepped at attacking the UW system, which affects basically every single person in the state, regardless of what party you're in, and he upset a lot of supporters. So we are going to do the right thing. We're going to do recall Walker again.
Wow.
It's a different cycle. We cannot collect signatures until at least 60 days before the inauguration date, which we'd want to go a couple days past just like the last time. So we would start collecting them right after the November election midterm, which would be we're talking November 7th, probably.
Is this 2015?
Yeah, it would be 2016 is when we would turn them in January. So right at the end of 2015. But the best right. part, Tom, is that we can organize all year long as this does not cross into any other campaigns that are being run at that time. And I'm here to tell people this is not Republican, Democrat. This is Wisconsin versus Scott Walker. And we can do this. And we owe it to ourselves and to this great country to do it. And yeah. it does not matter if we fail. We're Badgers. We never give up.
There you go. Here's the thing that concerns me, Mike. Of all of the bought and sold puppets for the Koch brothers, Scott Walker is perhaps one of the most conspicuous. I mean, just massive amounts of out-of-state money are the only reason that he's your governor, the only reason why the Republican Party controls Wisconsin. And the only reason why, I would say, why he hasn't already been, you know, charged with crimes. That's why I think he's going to be running for either president or vice president in a serious way on the Republican side. So, Mike, I wish you the very, very best with this. Please keep us up to date on it, okay?
You bet.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mike. Good to hear from you. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You know, remember that whole riff about precinct committee persons and all that stuff? Consider it. Do it. Check it out. Go to a local Democratic Party meeting. Check it out. See what, you know, how many of your friends do you have to bring to take it over? Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.